From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter. Made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you. And from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album. Available on iTunes.
I'm Sharon Gamble. Welcome to The Art of the Matter. On this week's program, we'll talk with Jim Naramore about his debut novel, chock full of magic, spirits, and mystery, and we'll see the Rhythm Discovery Center through kids' eyes. And don't forget, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do?
All that and much more right after the latest news from NPR. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. On today's show, we'll meet Indie Fringe's new creative team member and hear how Actors Theatre of Indiana is preparing for their new production about Judy Garland. But first, Theatre on the Square has presented some challenging material during its 2016-2017 season. They just finished a run of Neil LaBute's The Money Shot, and now it's getting ready to take on the highly regarded play The Mother with the Hat. Well, actually, the name of the play is a little stronger and more profane than Mother, but there's only so much we can say here. The Art of the Matter's Mark Allen talked to Theatre on the Square's artistic director, Laurie Raffel, who recently left TOTS, and director Gary Williams about The Mother with the Hat and the challenges it takes to present this show, but why it's worth it.
So first, Neil LaBute, and now this, The Mother with the Hat.
Yes.
Theatre on the Square is living on the edge these days, so... Tell me about your decisions to go from extremely edgy to things like Rock of Ages and A Christmas Story.
Well, you have to have things like A Christmas Story and Rock of Ages in order to afford to do Neil LaBute and Mother with the Hat. So we try to, and not always the same people come. I mean, our usual patrons came to see LaBute and we'll probably see this one. And then we have a whole new group of people that come to see A Christmas Story and Rock of Ages.
So that's kind of exciting in a way. I mean, you're not getting the same people and you're exposing theater to more folks in town. Huh?
That's right. Everybody in their 40s has called, I think, this week. And a lot of people are bringing a group. It seems to be, for Rock of Ages, it seems to be something... for adults to Uber downtown and drink and Uber home and sing to, you know, Night Ranger, so.
Okay. All right. Whatever they want to do.
That's okay. Right.
See, that's why I'm glad I'm in my 50s. I don't have to worry about that. So The Mother with the Hat is described, if you Google it, it's described as a high-octane verbal cage match about love, fidelity, and misplaced haberdashery. I would describe it, I think, as the story of addiction and how addicted you can get to not only drugs but to people and to your own way of thinking. And Gary, why don't you talk a little bit about this, about what the show is about?
Well, exactly. It's about a young man who's been in prison, and he's been there because he was selling drugs. And he comes back. He's in a substance abuse program, Alcoholics Anonymous, and he has a sponsor, Ralph D. And his girlfriend, who he's been with since the eighth grade, has welcomed him home, and he finds a hat that's not his in her apartment, and that starts the whole thing rolling. And it goes from there. It's a lot about blurred boundaries. It's a lot about whose morality are we living with, and what code are we living by.
Yeah, which I think is, despite the language and the amount of language and all the other things that go on in this play, I mean, I think it's a really relatable, relevant topic, no matter, you know, how you feel about the language and
right.
Everything else. Yeah.
Yeah, and the substance abuse. And I think, like most plays, the center of it is all about love, and that's what we end up with. I think after you've seen it, you realize that.
Yeah. Now, have you seen other productions?
Haven't seen another production. No.
Laurie, no?
No, I haven't. I read it a few years ago back when I worked at the Phoenix, and we had thought about doing it back then. And I really loved the script. And then for whatever reason, Brian Fonseca didn't do it. So when Gary brought it to me, I thought it was an excellent idea. But no, I've never seen a production.
Yeah. And this will be the Indianapolis debut of it, right?
Yes, it will.
So that'll be great. Okay. Let's talk about the challenges of this play, besides the name. Let's talk about casting. What's the casting process been like?
Well, we had open auditions for all the shows at Tots in August. Mm-hmm. It was August. And then I had callbacks in October. And finally got it cast in December, and have some really great people. Ralph D is Jeffrey Martin. A lot of people aren't familiar with him, African-American actor. Jackie is Eric Ryberg. Also, a lot of people might not be familiar with him. He hasn't done a lot on local stages. Veronica's Carrie Schlatter. She's been in a lot of shows in Indianapolis. Victoria's Chelsea Anderson, she's got a show at Diva Fest and was in the show I was in last November, Blackberry Winter. She should be familiar to a lot of audiences. And Cousin Julio is Ian Cruz, who's done a lot of Indianapolis theater.
Okay, good. What about the challenge of promoting a show that has a bit of profanity? Well, right in the name of the play.
Well, it is difficult. But it's got those two asterisks for the U and the C. And hopefully using exactly what they did on Broadway and, you know, the logo that you get when you get the package from Dramatis, hopefully people will recognize that. And and I also talk about on Broadway, it was Bobby Cannavale and
Chris Rock.
Yeah. And, Chris Rock didn't get tremendous, the critics didn't love him, but I can hear him saying so many of these lines.
Absolutely.
It's perfect for him. And Bobby Cannavale was kind of the first, you know, besides like Will and Grace, it was the first big thing that he did. And you gotta love these characters. I mean, there's so much to not love about them. You know, you just want them to get their act together and, you just like them and you want them to succeed. But so hopefully word of mouth on that and the actors and Gary's reputation, hopefully that's how we'll get people in.
You brought up critics, and I think it's important maybe to talk a little bit about the lack of theater criticism in our city at this point. Do you want to address that?
Well, yeah, I just posted about that on my Facebook, which is, kind of my outlet right now. But it is very, it's very frustrating. For instance, I got one person to write about Neil LaBute's The Money Shot. And that was, they saw it the first weekend, and then Jay Harvey, because I begged him, came the last weekend. But that doesn't do anything for getting the word out. And it is very frustrating. If you're not an IRT or a Phoenix or a Dance Kaleidoscope, it's tough to get people to come and see what you can do. And I just would love for them to come and see the little treasures that we have that that you might not prepare for, you might not think is going to come from Tots.
Okay. Yeah. Also, I think a way for the theater to stay vital is to be criticized. I mean, you can't just go around saying everything's perfect and everything's wonderful. You've got to know how to grow, and theater critics help you do that.
And since you're coming to the end of your season and you want to promote your next season, maybe, do you have ideas about what's coming up?
I really don't. I've already gotten about 16 submissions from people, and because we've done some that are local playwrights, I've gotten a lot of those, and also some oldies, but goodies, which is very interesting. Some that people did 10, 15 years ago that are great pieces, but people want to bring them back again, directors do.
Contributor Mark Allen with Theater on the Square's former artistic director Lori Raffel and director Gary Williams. The Mother with a Hat runs April 28th through May 13th at Theater on the Square, 727 Mass Ave. Go online for tickets and more information at tots.org. Steve Coswin needs to reinvent his life, but spirits are following him around, making it hard to move forward. Steve is the protagonist of Indianapolis author Jim Naramore's debut novel, The Arts of Legerdemain as Taught by Ghosts. I invited Jim to read us a bit of the first chapter, setting the scene to start.
Okay, so the book is really about a guy named Steve Coswin, who is putting his life back together after being in prison. And it's a very simple premise that he, you know, he's been released. He doesn't know what to do. His life has collapsed around him, and he wants to just sort of start to climb out of this hole that he's been in. And at the very beginning of the book, he's working in a bakery. His landlord and benefactor has rescued him and given him a job and given him a place to live. And he's taking a break at the bakery, and he and his cohorts at the bakery have seen someone put a poster up on the side of the road for a carnival that's coming to town. And they notice, they go over to see what the poster is about, and it's about a magic show that's part of the carnival. And everyone is sort of excited, oh, this looks interesting, this looks interesting. And Steve is sort of stunned by this poster because he believes he recognizes the woman who's the magician in the poster. And this is passage right here is at the very end of the first chapter after he has first seen the poster and gone back in, and now he's going back out to look at the poster again. So I'll start reading it. At the end of the day, the bakery staff sifted into the parking lot. It was still raining steadily and turning a little cooler. Thunder rumbled in the distance. Steve caught up with Omar. Hey, can you drop this off at the post office on your way home? It'll get picked up faster, he asked, as he looked across the parking lot at the poster again. Another one? Said Omar, glancing at the envelope in Steve's hand. Alaska? Eighth one in the last 3 weeks, man. That's a lot of job applications. You having any luck? Not yet. Omar jogged out into the parking lot, but the image of Lawrence Renard summoning her ghost summoned Steve back to the pole. Refusing to be called, the other bakers faded toward their battered cars, like five gray ghosts in the darkling rain. Steve was still standing in front of the poster when his bus pulled up, stopped, paused, and then drove on again down the hill, in the same direction that the trash bag guy had ridden. He looked at the poster as the rain beat down, causing it to wrinkle slightly. His face was still, not hard like stone, but soft and still, like a freshly made bed in a quiet bedroom. There was only remembering. Fox, he said. Hearing his own voice shook him out of his trance. He looked at the ground. His body felt strange to him, like he hadn't noticed it before and didn't quite know whose it was. With great effort, he walked through the rain across the street to stand at the bus stop and wait for the next bus. And the bus came, and he dripped his way on and rode home.
So Steve is at a fascinating crossroads in his life. Something has happened. I have to be careful how we talk about this because there are wonderful surprises in the book, and sure, I don't want to give them away. But something has happened that has caused his life to just crash in on itself, and he's reorganizing his life and setting out for a new direction.
Right. He really had nothing when he came out. His life really had just sort of collapsed, and he was in this void. And the one thing that he's been clinging to is this letter that his sister had sent him. He had been invited. She is living in New Zealand, and she had invited him to come out and be with her and get a fresh start, that she would give him a job and set him up, but he had to be able to pay his own way to get out there. And New Zealand is expensive to get to from the Midwest. And so he's trying to put together the money to be able to do that. He sees that as the one shining light that he has left. So his whole focus is on, I need to be able to get money. I need a job that pays me well. So he's looking for jobs. He's doing anything he can. In the meantime, he's in this very dead-end job that's just managing to keep his head above the water and just managing to, you know, keep food in his mouth while he searches and tries to sort of see what's going on with his life.
Steve lives in a world full of sleight of hand, full of hints of different dimensions. How did you come up with the idea for this novel? Did it start with ghosts? Did it start with magic?
No, actually, it started with the theme, the deeper theme of the book and the relationship that Steve had with Fox. The character of Fox, this woman that he had a relationship with in the past, is a character that recurs in my writing all the time.
Really?
In a different name and a different guise, but this sort of theme tends to run through most of the stuff I write. And so I had this notion of a man who has been left by a woman who is out seeking better things and bigger things, and he's sort of left in the dust, and what is he going to do? I had a plot set up for a different sort of story, and at the same time then I had for sort of out of the blue dropped in a whole bunch of magic references. My father was an amateur magician, and he loved magic, so I grew up with him telling me stories about magic and showing me magic tricks, and I was starting to hear all of these stories about magic shows, and things would show up on TV about magic shows. So I think that kind of seeped into my brain, and I melded the two of them together and came up with this idea that this guy who was getting out of prison, who has been left, was a stage magician, and it sort of went from there.
Jim Naramore's debut novel is The Arts of Legerdemain as Taught by Ghosts. Find out more and order the book at the publisher's website, belloute.com. That's BELLELUTTE.com. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. Later this hour, Judy Garland at a vulnerable crossroads. But first, Eat Drink Indie's Jolene Ketzenberger checks out Urban Awareness Gardens with Jason Michael Thomas and Casey Kustas.
So we're here talking with Jason Michael Thomas about urban gardening. So tell me a little bit about Urban Awareness Gardens.
We started Urban Awareness Gardens, which we call Urban Ag Indie, so the awareness gardens ties into the ag. We started it a few years ago because, for a few reasons, we really enjoy fresh produce and food, and we wanted to be a part of the change we wanted to see in the world, basically trying to make the world more sustainable. Mm-hmm. And started growing things, and it was started very small.
Now, where were you growing? Is it right in the city?
It is, yes. It's just north of 16th and Central. So I have a property there, and we've got a house with a half an acre. And, yeah, it's been a real growing experience.
So it is right in the middle of the city.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So what do you grow? And I don't want to say a backyard garden, because it sounds like it's bigger than a backyard garden.
Yeah, I think once you get over, you know, a quarter acre, it starts to become an urban farm.
Right.
But yeah, we're at about a half acre, and actually we've got a couple other other lots around town, too, that we're growing on. But really, we grow a lot of stuff. Let's see. I think our first real seller that we really enjoy growing is tomatoes. We have at least 30 kinds of tomatoes. And so Casey here is she's really our seed genius. She buys the coolest seeds. When the catalogs come in, she is so excited, and she just flips through and just finds all the coolest stuff.
Now, this is Casey Kustas. So you're a gardener, right?
Yes.
Tell me just a little bit about what you might be getting started on right now. Is it too early, or are you out there getting things going?
I have a couple of things that are outdoors right now. They are cold weather crops, and they are kind of an experiment. Most of the work's happening indoors still. Our tomatoes, eggplant, peppers, crops like that needed to be started a couple of weeks ago to get a head start on the growing season.
Sure.
So we got a lot of indoor lights, a lot of stuff growing in there. They're probably an inch to 2 inches tall now. Very cute still, very small.
But this is one of the problems that people make, I think, one of the mistakes they make. They try to put these things out too early, and we get a few nice warm spring days, and there they are wanting to, like, plant tomatoes or something, and it's just too early yet, right?
Right. They really don't like it when it's this cold. Usually you aim to plant things like that outside, and the last frost date, which around here is typically May 8th, so no earlier than that. You can if you're willing to chance it and cover them up and do extra work, but it's usually not worth it.
Now, what else comes on? You know, what else are you going to be planting later on as the season goes on?
We will have squash. We will be doing melons this year. We're going to have a lot more herbs than we have in the past, probably 10 different kinds of herbs going on. Marigolds, you know, those flowers that keep pests out of your garden. Mm-hmm. They just don't like the smell, so they're good to have around, and they're also beautiful. Carrots, beets. We're going to have lettuce, a little bit of everything.
So this is a big operation. It sounds like it has really expanded over the
blossom.
Years. So it's really blossomed. So tell me how you started it.
You know, it's just one of those things. It was probably 4 years ago.
Uh-huh.
We just started growing things that we loved, and It was very small, right? So then we had these amazing tomatoes, and, you know, local restaurants were interested. I think the first people we provided some to were Shoe Fly.
In the neighborhood, right?
Correct, yes. Keeping it very local. And then Tinker Street showed up on the scene.
Right.
And Braden really enjoys some of the things we find.
Chef Braden Kellner at Tinker Street.
Correct.
Right?
He likes some of the off-the-beaten-path things that we provide.
And like what?
Well, last year we had radish pods. Basically, if you let your radishes go to seed, meaning, you know, the radish that you see is just kind of the
tuber. Yeah, so they shoot up a little flower,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and they shoot up pretty tall, actually, you know, 2 to 3 feet. And then they have flowers on the end, and then they have little pods that kind of look like soybeans. You know, most people pick them before that because they want to eat their radishes.
Of course.
But I looked it up, and I found that in, you know, some countries, they pickle them and use them in dishes. So he really loved it. He pickled them, and they were on their beet salad all summer.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so if you had the beet salad, you ate some of our radish pods.
Oh, that's great.
You can hear Jolene Ketzenberger's Eat, Drink, Indy Saturday mornings at 11 on WFYI HD2, The Point. Indy Fringe has a new associate director, and WFYI's Jill Dittmeyer is here to tell us more. Tell us.
Well, George Wallace has been involved with and also the executive director of the highly acclaimed Orlando Fringe. He's been with that group for 12 years. But a meeting with Indy Fringe president and CEO Pauline Moffitt last August changed everything.
I like to get out and see what other festivals are doing. And I came to Indianapolis and I fell in love with the city. And I jokingly said to Pauline, the CEO, that if she created a job for me, I would move to Indianapolis. And about 3 months later, my phone rang and she said, oh, hey, I've created a job and we're getting grant funding. So if you were serious, there's a job for you. So the job was essentially created for me. So I was really excited and I came back in December, found an apartment and gave my notice in Orlando, and I started today.
So since you created the job, what are you going to be doing for the Fringe?
You know, today I started, so it's kind of a learning curve. But I did work in Orlando for 13 years. I was the executive director. And for the past 5 years, we had a 30% increase in audience, and we've done a lot of community outreach. And I see this great potential here in Indianapolis to do a lot of cross promotions and work with other theaters and other nonprofits that maybe, you know, traditional theaters wouldn't work with. So working with kids with autism or working with African American playwrights and storytellers to come in and utilize our space. So I'm really excited. And I think Indianapolis is such an up-and-coming growing city with the arts and cultural scene. I don't know a whole lot about it yet. I'm still learning, but I'm really excited.
And now the Fringe Theater itself has two theaters in it to program
it
as well.
It does. Yes, yes, I'm so excited with the year-round programming. That was something that's new to me. We had year-round programming in Orlando, but we rented the space. So we were at the mercy of when theaters were dark, and we had a lot of Monday night performances or industry nights. And it's going to be great here because we have two great spaces.
What do you think is one of the most common misconceptions among people who hear about the Fringe Theater? What don't they know that they should know?
Well, one of the things that I always tell people is Fringe really is for everyone. I think the non-curated or uncensored piece of Fringe scares a lot of people, and they just think it's this real avant-garde, scary thing, and it's not. You know, you can come to Fringe and you can see some of the best theater that you've ever seen. You can also see some of the worst theater you've ever seen. And that's okay. You know, you kind of fly by the seat of your pants, but it's not scary and it's not this big thing that you have to be afraid of. You know, we're very welcoming, and for artists, they get to try something new and experiment, and I just love that facet of fringe festivals.
Is there one thing that you experienced at the Orlando Fringe Festival that you really want to bring to the Indianapolis Fringe Festival?
Yeah, you know, we have a really great solid kids program, and I would like to do some more children's programming because, you know, it is the next generation of fringe goers. So I'm really excited to kind of delve in and look to see what opportunities may be available to do some additional children's programming.
And because you are so plugged into fringe festivals around the world, what is going on elsewhere that you also want to bring to Indianapolis Fringe?
Well, I just think this, the whole celebration of Fringe Festivals this year in particular is a really big year. It's the 70th anniversary of the grandfather of them all in Edinburgh. So I think just bringing that real big celebratory feeling to Fringe this year, and we have some really great things that are going to be happening. We have some midnight cabarets that I want to work on, and maybe expanding the beer tent a little bit and making it a real fun celebration down on Mass Avenue.
The 2017 Indie Fringe Festival takes place August 16th through the 27th on Mass Ave in downtown Indianapolis. But there are performances year-round at the Indianapolis Fringe Theater. It's located at the corner of College and Mass Ave. And you can go to their website, indiefringe.org, for all of the performances any time of the year. And Sharon, this year with the Fringe Festival, they share a weekend with Gen Con. So they are going to close down part of the 300 block of Massachusetts Avenue for a big party.
Wow.
Something for everybody to look forward to.
That'll be fascinating chemistry when those two worlds collide, and they may very well collide. I love it.
It'll be fringy.
And you know what? I have an item taking a place at the Fringe Theater on our calendar that we call
What'll We Do?
What do you have?
Well, coming up still, just right around the corner here, April 21st is the Christian Moore House Guild Book and Author Luncheon. I think there's still a few tickets available for that. It's their big fundraiser for the Christian Moore House, and a variety of authors coming to town to be part of it, including the New York Times bestselling author Christina Baker Klein. And she wrote Orphan Train, and her newest book is A Piece of the World. It's the story about the painting by Andrew Wyeth of Christina's world, The Woman in the Painting. And I was able to interview Christina a while back, and we're going to share that interview on an upcoming episode of The Art of the Matter. But get your tickets now at christamoreguild.org for the book author luncheon on the 21st.
Can't wait to hear that conversation. In fact, we're going to hear it next week. No Exit Performance and Zach Rosing Productions are combining their forces for a production called Mad Mad Hercules. Zach Knight is the director. It's a new original script by local playwright Bennett Ayers, and it is described as a raucous, raunchy, R-rated ride through Greek mythology's most famous hero tale. It's recommended for audiences 16 years and older, so if you have a middle schooler studying mythology, think twice before taking her to this. The production runs April 21st through May 7th at Indie Fringe. Mad Mad Hercules.
Coming up on April the 16th at 8 p.m. at the Garfield Park Arts Center, film historian Eric Grayson, you've heard him many times, he's spoken with Sharon many times here on The Art of the Matter, he is screening the silent film Little Orphaned Annie. And, of course, this is by Hoosier author James Whitcomb Riley. A great film for all ages. Admission is just $5. There's free parking. More information at gpacarts.org.
So, on this Saturday morning, you have a little one who's already figured out where the Easter candy is and has consumed a little bit too much sugar, and you need to burn off calories. Well, hippity-hoppity Easter's on its way and has landed at the Indianapolis Zoo. Guests can celebrate the arrival of spring by visiting baby animals, participating in crafts, checking out the butterfly exhibit at the conservatory, and much, much more that's going on this very weekend at the Indianapolis Zoo.
And coming up on May the 6th at the Tube Factory down there in Garfield Park, it is, all you coffee lovers, get ready for this. It's the event. It's called the Indianapolis Cup. There are 6 baristas from around town, plus coffee aficionados from across the Midwest are all gathering for a cup off is how they're they're saying this. So it's a brand new festival, and they're raising money for Project Alianza, which is to benefit the children. Who are the children of the workers in the coffee-growing regions of the world. So it's $75 from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., and then you can be awake for like the next 7 days after that, probably. But tinkercoffee.com for more information on the Indianapolis Cup on May the 6th.
So if you've had plenty of caffeine and you want to go check out a fun band on Saturday night, April 22nd, Progressive Lenses, love that name. It is a progressive rock group, but its members in some cases are better known for their classical musicianship. It plays eclectic music and fun arrangements. They're playing an evening of progressive rock music classics. Progressive rock music classics. I see the Google search right in front of me about that. Go ahead and do it. Please do it. They're going to be at the Grove House in Fountain Square on April 22nd at 9 o'clock. So have your cup of joe before you go so you can stay up and hear what they're playing.
Speaking of classical music, we want to give a shout out to Drew Peterson. He was selected as the American Pianist Society's Crystal DeHaan Classical Fellowship winner. It was that year-long competition. You enjoyed all the interviews that we had with the five finalists. And Drew Peterson is the winner, and now he is on a two-year mission with marketing, financial support, to continue his amazing career as a classical pianist. He will also be the artist in residence at the University of Indianapolis. Congratulations to Drew Peterson and the good folks at the American Pianists Association here in Indianapolis.
Fantastic. Pamela Fisher and Joseph DeFazio will be presenting a free flute and piano recital at the Bartlett Chapel United Methodist Church in Avon on Sunday, April 23rd. The concert features music of Debussy, Fauré, Copland, and more. And once again, that's Sunday, April 23rd at 3 at the Bartlett Chapel United Methodist Church in Avon. And if you're looking for more things to see and do, you can always find out more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide, or join us again next week for our calendar we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and central Indiana. Your host is Sharon Gamble. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202, or you can email us at aotm@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. In just a bit, five songs with Kyle Long. But first, it's time for With Kids. WFYI's Jill Sheridan and her two young children check out our area's art scenes to explore what makes an impact on young Hoosiers. And this week, Jill's friend and her two sons came along to check out the Rhythm Discovery Center in downtown Indianapolis, one of only a few percussion museums in the country, and they made a lot of noise.
The Rhythm Discovery Center is located in the basement level of the Circle Center Mall in downtown Indianapolis, right below the Arts Garden. This hidden gem is one of only a handful of percussion museums around the world and the only one in the U.S. The center is geared for the whole family to enjoy and explore, but there's something special about percussion that's a draw for young children. I tell Joshua Simmons, the museum's executive director, that some of Veronica and Max's first toys were percussion instruments.
Even before you bought that, they were probably banging on pots or pans or a crib or a table. It's inherent. Each one of us has rhythm. I hear a lot of people say, oh, I don't have any rhythm. But everyone has rhythm. I mean, our heartbeat is, you know, that's the core of who we are, and that's rhythm.
The museum is largely interactive with hundreds of pieces of equipment that children can touch and play, and families can join in the fun.
These kids right here may or may not have any musical experience or training, but they can come and make a sound and try something right away, and that's very unique to our instrument.
A large corner of the center is dedicated to rhythm discovery.
What does that noise sound like, do you think?
A frog.
Frog?
Hundreds of instruments. It has two isolated rooms where you can go in and rock out and jam, and no one can hear you if that is something that you're worried about, which you shouldn't be. It has the opportunity to do that. And then lots of instruments from around the world, whether Western or from Latin America, from Africa, but just a chance to really try.
Keisha Griffin with her 18-month-old twins, Jonathan and Josiah, were visiting from New York City. She says they don't have anything like this there, and her kids really enjoy music.
They actually have a real guitar, which they love. They love their drums that I bought from like little Walmart, but they also have like just this love of boxes and banging and just everything is a drum, especially for Jonathan. Josiah, it's more like everything is a piano.
The center offers group tours for schools and other organizations to come in and experience their own drum circle. It also houses the Percussive Arts Society's collection.
This is a portion of our collections, our archives. We're about 4,000 artifacts there, which we started collecting in the 80s, but more in the early 90s. And then we could preserve the history of so much of this percussion from around the world.
One of the highlights for everyone was the drum set made out of Legos.
All Legos. All Legos.
Just
like a regular drum set.
My friend's son, another Max, was ready to rock. Rhythm Discovery Center opened in 2009. Indianapolis was chosen to host the museum because of strong community support and a long percussive history.
WFYI's Jill Sheridan and friends visited the Rhythm Discovery Center. You can find the beat yourself at 110 West Washington Street. Memberships as well as individual admissions are available, and you can learn about exhibits, drum circles, and much more at their website, rhythmdiscoverycenter.org. It's April 23rd, 1961, and 38-year-old Judy Garland is about to take the stage at Carnegie Hall for what the New York Times called the Concert of the Century. Beyond the Rainbow is Actors Theater of Indiana's new production, and it takes audience members to that year and that storied stage and into the memories, fears, and hopes of Judy Garland. I invited director Don Farrell and actors Grace Sell and Roger Ortman to tell me what it's like to create that world.
All right. I'm going to start with Don, but I want to hear from you, Grace and Roger, too, about what is it? There's something about Judy Garland that we just can't get enough of her. We can't see enough shows about her, read enough biographies. What is it?
I think she invested herself completely in everything she did. And I think there's a catharsis that we as an audience experience when we see her sing those songs. Other people would perform songs, but she actually became the song for us. So for those of us who might not be able to really speak our truth at times, or maybe not be able to verbalize exactly how we feel, we lived it through her. And I think that, such an iconic performer and human being that she was, she lived everything. And tragics, too, the story that she had, how she, how the eventual tragedy came about. It's unfortunate. It really wasn't her own doing. It was kind of a product of all many of those child stars of that age,
mm-hmm.
of that time. I think the innocence that she had, and we were even talking about it on the drive down before mm-hmm. coming, and the the fear of being alone, the relationships that she had with her mother and her father, and those that maybe trying to look for that same sense of security and safety in those that she had relationships with down the road, whether it be male or female, good friends with Kate Thompson. She was one of her best friends that she trusted, but went through a lot of tough times with. She saw all the good and the bad as well and still loved her, And I think that's a thing that we as those who love Judy Garland and can really appreciate her, we loved her good and bad.
Yeah.
For good and bad.
Yeah. Grace, what do you think?
Well, revisiting Judy and preparing for the show, it just strikes you again, this incandescent, burning talent in this tiny person that still has so much power to strike us. We've got the talent on this side and the confidence in what she performs. And then on the other side, you have this vulnerable,
you know, self-doubting little person who is just buffeted by these characters all around her. And I think her humanity, balanced with her incredible talent, it just, it knocks our socks off every time we see her, because she reaches us emotionally as a talent, and then also as just a human being. It's moving and tragic all over again every time you revisit her.
And Roger, one of your characters is her third husband.
Third,
right?
Husband, yeah. It was his second marriage, her third. Yeah, Sid Luft. I read an interview where Sid said that when Judy talked to you, your heart just melted.
Wow.
She was 5 foot, beautiful woman, you know, had porcelain skin, and just, to what Grace was saying earlier, just that combination of vulnerability and a powerhouse. Many people who saw the concert, the Carnegie Hall concert, said she played to the back of the room. And so even the person who was in, you know, the last seat in the back, it felt personal. And she just imbued that throughout that that palace. So,
And Don, why don't you describe the setup, sort of the plot device that through which her story is told, speaking
sure.
of that concert?
We are recreating April 23rd, 1961, and turning the Studio Theater at the Center for the Performing Arts and transforming it into Carnegie Hall, the setting of our play. It is really like even though it's her concert and many of her set list, really, it's from that show, that concert. You know, many of her, she would say, the story of my life is in my songs. And really, that set list is it's perfection as far as following her life and seeing the journey. So as she's singing her songs, it's triggering memories for her. For us as an audience, it's almost as if time stands still within the during at the time of the concert, and we start seeing these vignettes of memories of her when she was a young child as Frances Ethel Gum, her true name as she was born, and how she became known as Judy Garland, and how that name changed, and all of the characters that came in and out of her life throughout. So we follow all the way from when she was a young child all the way up to when she was only 38 years old when she performed this amazing comeback concert.
But more than four decades worth of experience.
Absolutely.
It seems like. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, you know, I was talking to a good friend of mine who was actually at that concert.
What? Wow.
And Patricia Wilson, she's just I can't speak enough about this lovely lady who is an American treasure in and of herself, who was on Broadway in Fiorello years ago and many other shows. But she was at that concert, and she was like anybody who was anybody was at that concert. Mm. And the feeling of watching this little powerhouse of a woman giving every bit of herself to those numbers where you think she has to take a breath, she can't finish, and she would just take it. Or even in between phrases, she's like gasping for the air to get into the next phrase. She was just invested completely into her performance. It was amazing. It sounds electric. I wish I would have been there.
Great role model for any actor or singer, too. Yeah. As fascinating as it is to play Judy Garland, you guys have your own kind of fascinating charge, which is mm-hmm. you're playing all these different people who affected her. Do you have a favorite of the character of the many characters you're playing?
Oh, goodness. I would have to say Hedda Hopper, of all things. Reading back about her, she was quite a character. She played over 100 movies herself, but never found fame and fortune that way. Not until she started gossiping about. I mean, she became so powerful and so wealthy. She bought a mansion and nicknamed it the house that fear built.
That takes moxie.
Yeah, she's a powerful woman, and she's a great deal of fun to play.
And to local actors, if you haven't been getting the parts you want, we do not recommend that as a career path.
Amen. Amen to that.
Roger, favorite character from
oh,
this?
Oh, my goodness. It would be a strong tie between Louis Mayer and Sid Luft. More so Sid, I think, because Sid loved Judy. He really did. You know, really tried to take care of her as a protector. In some ways, I think, you know, with what she was battling with, her own demons, etc., To have someone, and of all the marriages and all the relationships, he was there in her life for 12 years. And so a very short life of 47 years, I mean, that obviously is someone who cared about her deeply. When, as he said in an interview, when it was good, it was really good. And when it was bad, I mean, it was a boxing match, basically, at that point. And so, because he was an amateur boxer. And so, yeah, I like that because it's an opportunity. It's not just a one-dimensional character. It's a character who is a real person and goes through the struggles of any relationship with someone that they dearly love. And not all the memories of that relationship are always positive, but the ones that are, I think this show does a great job of bringing out all those memories of the people in her life. So I would say Sid Luff is a character I enjoy.
Director Don Farrell and actors Grace Sell and Roger Ortman, all part of Actors Theater of Indiana's next production. It's called Beyond the Rainbow, and it opens April 28th and runs through May 14th at the Studio Theater at the Center for the Performing Arts in Carmel. The show features two dozen of Garland's most famous tunes, including The Man That Got Away, Get Happy, and, of course, Over the Rainbow. Learn more at atistage.org.
Over the rainbow, way up high, there's a land that I heard of once in a lullaby.
A Cultural Manifesto's Kyle Long talks five songs with an interesting community member each week. Here's The Newest Journey.
I'm Kyle Long from Cultural Manifesto. I'm here with multi-instrumentalist Gerardo of the group Sweet Poison Victim. Gerardo, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
As I mentioned, you're a member of Sweet Poison Victim.
That is correct.
Can you give me a description of what Sweet Poison Victim sounds like? I always struggle to come up with a quick way to describe the group sound.
Well, if you can't describe it, then I can't either.
I would say Sweet Poison Victim's a rock band, but there are elements of African music and Latin music. And does that sound right to you?
No.
Okay, then how would you describe the band?
Well, it's a group of people that just know how to play instruments. And yeah, we'll like different types of music, so we just play the music that we like.
Kwesi Brown is kind of the leader of the group. He's from Ghana, so there's a Ghanaian music influence in
That's
the high
right.
life.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And tell us about your background.
I come from listening to metal, and more lately in my life, cumbia and African music.
Well, maybe the five songs you're going to share with us will give us some insight on your musical DNA here. So what's your first song?
The first song is called Cumbia Profeta. It's by Jaime Gale y sus Profetas. It's a really cool song. It's got like a very like Brazilian samba like part to it. And I just learned about this song and I'm like hooked on it, so... The second song is by Onda Tropica from Great Quantic in Frente Cumbiero. It's called Hummingbird.
And Quantic was a British electronic music producer.
Well, he still is.
Yeah, Quantic is a British electronic music producer and musician who traveled to Colombia and started this. It's kind of a super group of Colombian musicians from the golden age of Colombian music with, as you mentioned, a member of Frente
Cumbiero.
Yeah. What about this group appeals to you?
It's just like a meeting of old and new. I'm a big fan of Quantic and Frente Cumbiero, and I'm a fan of old school Colombian music, so that's like two worlds coming together to form a really amazing new thing, sound. Third song is Abby Krenzel, and the song is, I don't know how to pronounce this though. Llevo Atse Oye. Abby Krenzel is probably Kwesi's hero.
Kwesi, who's the drummer and founder sort of Sweet Poison Victim.
Right. Well, maybe not hero, but you can tell he has a pretty big influence on him. And this song is one of my favorites from the High Life music. On the YouTube comment section, someone said it's the best High Life song to come out of Ghana. So
yeah, and High Life was a form of Ghanaian popular music that came to prominence in the mid-early 60s and still to this day continues to grow and develop into new forms. And that's a big foundation of Sweet Poison Victim sound.
Right, that is right. That's correct. My fourth song is Dr. K. Yassi's Noble Kings. Then the song is called Sichi High Life. And this one is probably my favorite High Life song. It just really captures everything, like the horns, the bass, the drums, everything.
Fifth and final song, Gerardo from Sweet Poison Victim.
Final song is from Límite 21. It's called Estás Enamorada. And this part, this song is, well, all of these groups' songs are crazy. They got crazy bass lines and they're really moving. And if you want to dance, you just listen to this.
And Gerardo, Sweet Poison Victim has a show coming up. This episode of Art of the Matter is going to air Saturday, April 15th, and Sweet Poison have a show tonight at the Pioneer in Fountain Square. Is that right?
That is right. We're playing with the X.
Thank you, Gerardo, for sharing these songs with us today.
Thank you.
Picked a good mix of music. I approve and appreciate the selection. Thank
if you. Kyle Long approves, then I'm good with that.
Thanks.
Hear Kyle's A Cultural Manifesto on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio Wednesday nights at 9 or Saturday nights at 10. Thanks for listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and today's contributors included Mark Allen, Jill Dittmeyer, and Jill Sheridan. Hear The Art of the Matter Saturday mornings at 7 or join us Thursday nights at 9 after Indivisible. And remember, you can always listen to and share our podcast at WFYI.org. Next week, Christina Baker Klein talks about Orphan Train and how Andrew Wyeth inspired her new novel, and Ken Scott crafts hunting pouches that look centuries old. And of course, we'll have our arts calendar we call What'll We Do? All of that and so much more on The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. The Art of the Matter is executive producer Roxana Caldwell, producer Melissa Davis, contributor Jill Dittmeyer, and host Sharon Gamble. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.